I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Gisele Barreto Fetterman was just 7 years old when she came to America fleeing the violence of Brazil, settling in Queens with her mother, her grandmother, and brother. Being undocumented, her mother taught her how to be invisible for fear of being deported. She also taught Gisele to be resourceful, doing curbside shopping and dumpster diving, giving throwaways a second life. Gisele became a citizen in 2009 and today is no longer invisible. Her husband, John Fetterman, was Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania and in 2022 was elected to the U.S. Senate. They live in Braddock, a former steel town outside of Pittsburgh, where she opened the Free Store, where people in need can shop for used or discarded clothing, books, and other essentials, and a food surplus store, 412 Food Rescue. She just wrote a book, Radical Tenderness, about why being vulnerable is a source of strength. She describes herself as a softie, a big crier, who looks for consensus, not conflict. She's also candid about the impact of her husband's very public hospitalization for depression on their family. And she joins us today on The Connection to talk about her life, why we need more tenderness, the Trump administration's targeting of undocumented immigrants, and how she navigates the political world. And she's here with us in our Philadelphia studios. And Gisele Barreto Fetterman, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Thank you. I'm already crying. I can't even explain it.
Oh, you're already crying. That is hilarious. And I have to confess up front, since you're crying, I am a big crier myself. And I generally am crying once or twice a day. So just
same.
So you know.
Yeah.
Okay. So if we're crying together, I think we'll be fine. Well, let me start with radical tenderness. Why do we need radical tenderness?
I think we need it more than ever. I think that we're lacking in tenderness altogether, not only radical aspect of it, but altogether. I think we've become so cruel to each other. I think that's celebrated in our culture. It's celebrated in this country. And I think we need more of the opposite.
Let me quote you from your book. She says, I'm able to approach others with tenderness because I do not flatten my own emotional experiences. I let in hurt, sadness, and joy in equal measure. Yet this emotional range is discouraged in society that places more value on traditionally masculine traits rather than those perceived as feminine. You see, this is gendered?
I think it is. It can be very gendered, and I think it often is. And I think we've lived through many movements of empowerment, and those are all wonderful movements. But I think that the people that don't have that strength that presents it that way, there's also a place for them, right? I'm never going to be the loudest person in the room. My voice is going to shake, but that voice still matters. And I think that that voice is not celebrated.
Do you see this as part of, you know, Martin Luther King or Gandhi's nonviolence, or is this just something that comes out of who you are as a person, as a woman?
I think that's just who I am, but I think there's a lot of me out there that also are the same way, but don't have a place where they feel they fit in.
The subtitle is about this unkind world that we live in, this cruel world. What do you think is driving cruelty, so much cruelty, and even the sort of joy of hating other people?
I think we've become accustomed to expecting the worst out of people. I think folks have such a guard up, and I joke in the book, there's a story where in my high school yearbook, someone signed it and said, for the first 3 years, I thought you were a fake bitch. And it turns out you were actually just really nice. So I think we have a guard up, and whether we're afraid to get hurt or be taken advantage of or all these things that we don't own, right? I say that should be on the other side. So I think that's what, there's this fight to show how tough we are. And that turns into cruelty and meanness, and it's celebrated. It really is. It's celebrated. It's the viral moment, and it just makes me sad.
Well, sure, those viral moments, they're so anonymous, so they take on a life of their own. But you also seem to see pain and sadness behind people's unkindness, their cruelty. How come?
Right. I think that it's a flag. Like, there's a great line that says the child who asks for it the worst way is the one who needs love the most. right? I think they are cries for help in some way, or, you know, needing love or attention. And my grandma always used to say, you know, you give what's inside of you. She's like, Giselle, you don't understand these things because it's not inside of you. But what you see, the worst of people, they're letting out parts of them that are there. And I think they are shields, right? They're protective barriers. But they just keep growing. They're not changing.
I'm sure you've heard that phrase, hurt people hurt people.
For sure.
I mean, is that how you see it?
I think that's definitely a part of it, but I don't think it's only that. I think it is celebrated in media, in television, in relationships, that toughness is something to be celebrated. They never say, oh my gosh, this person walked away from a fight. How cool. It's like, this person won the fight. So I think it's a culture has moved that way. And, you know, I wish the pendulum would move the other way.
So what makes you such a softie, to use your own words?
I've always been that way. I think some people just are that way. You know, I love people. I love flawed people.
You love flawed people.
Yeah, because we all are. I love getting to know, you know, everything about them. I want to make friends everywhere I go. I really, really care about everything. And
now you're crying again. Oh my God.
No, I mean, this is very normal. But I think, you know, it's, you know, we are born crying, and along the way we are told to stop. And I think I never stopped.
No, and nor should you ever stop or be embarrassed about it. But if people said to me, oh, Giselle, you know, toughen up, you know.
Every day.
And what do you say?
I say that I'm fine just the way you are. I am. I like myself. I like this version of me, and I don't think I need to change. And I don't think other people do too. You know, I think we should embrace who we are. But if who we are is a big softie, and we've been hiding that part of us, then maybe let that power out more.
You know, you got me thinking about crying, because it's something you and I do. You maybe a little bit more than me, but something that we both do. And on the one hand, I mean, it can be manipulative. I think that's fair to say. But it also can be a very powerful thing to do. It can be very disarming to somebody, especially if they come in hot, to see someone be so vulnerable.
I think it definitely, and I think I learned that in high school. I don't know if I share that part, but you know, there was a girl that wanted to fight me in high school. It was my first ever fight. And she thought I kissed her boyfriend. I did, but I didn't know.
You didn't know it was her boyfriend,
No,
right?
I didn't know. And she said, you know, meet me at the tree behind the school at 4:30. And I started to cry. I mean, that was like my response. And I think she wasn't expecting that. And she didn't want to fight me any longer. It wasn't manipulative. It was just my natural response, because I didn't want to fight her or anybody.
Well, nothing wrong with it. Let me just reinforce that. Let me go back to the, I guess, your beginning. You began, obviously, in Brazil, but when you came to America, this was December 1989, and you were 7 years old, came from Brazil, settled in Queens. What was your first, I mean, you're a little kid, you're a little girl. What's your first memory of America?
Cold.
It was cold. December, yeah.
It was a terrible blizzard. I remember the like little nose hairs freezing, like they're all sticking out, frozen. I remember the cold. A lot of the other memories are from pictures, right? It's hard to remember that time. It all moved very quickly, both packing and leaving and starting over. A lot of it, you know, it was a blur. But I do remember the cold.
The cold.
And also, like, my mom made everything like it was a game. Right, I love Tetris my whole life and games like that, solving puzzles. And for her, these were all adventures and hurdles that we had to overcome to get to the next level. And tomorrow we try again if we didn't pass the level today. So she really, you know, I had this mindset of these are challenges we have to overcome each day.
Why did she want to bring her family from Brazil to America?
She was tired of the violence, and she shared the moment she decided was a conversation with my aunt where violence had been so normalized. The way folks speak about violence in Rio is very much like this is just a part of life. Mm-hmm. And you're almost used to it. You expect it. It's not a shock when it happens. And she said she'd never want it to be normal for my brother or I. And so she said, we're going to try this. And if it doesn't work, then we go somewhere else. And if that doesn't work, then we try something else. She was very good about reminding us that you can start over. every day is another chance to start over.
She had multiple degrees, as you write, and as I understand, and when she came to America, she worked basically as a domestic worker.
Mm-hmm. She did. She was a co-check girl in the evening at a nightclub. She cleaned a couple hotels, catered, and then cleaned homes.
Did she see that as below herself?
Never. No? She would say, I would clean toilets for the rest of my life knowing that you guys are safe.
Wow.
She's very cool.
She's very cool. And it seems, again, the way you write, and as I have read about you, that you grew up surrounded by love.
Very much so.
With your grandmother.
No.
Are you going to cry again?
No, I'm going to cry a lot. I cried on the train on the way here. Something totally unrelated. Yes, my grandmother, my uncle, my mother, and my cousins. I mean, you know, there was no lacking in that department.
You overstayed your visa and became undocumented. What was the scariest part about that?
I think learning that I was, you know, that we were still doing something wrong, even though, like, I had wonderful grades at school and we paid our taxes and we volunteered. We did everything right. And knowing that, wait, I'm still not in the right here and something could happen. My mom was a lot less fearful. She just, if it happens, then we start over somewhere else. Huh. You know, that was her mentality always. But for me, it was like I'd have to leave my friends and my school. It felt a lot scarier to me. And it was like the unexpected knocks at the door. Or if a police car pulls up next to me. There were so many moments of that.
Where you felt frightened, this is it?
Absolutely.
She said to you, I love you, you know, have a good day in school, be invisible.
Right.
And being visible meaning just don't do anything that calls attention to yourself.
Right. And it was a protection. It was a way to protect me. It was, you know, we were uninsured, so I really couldn't get injured. I really wasn't supposed to play any active sports because if there was an injury, then, you know, that was a problem. So it was how can we draw the least amount of attention to ourselves, certainly in a negative way of any kind. And that's what we did.
Almost up on a break here. Did you have to sort of make yourself small? I mean, to be invisible, to sort of shrink who you were?
I think that's already a part of my personality. Like, I didn't want to have a wedding. I never liked birthday parties for me. Like, I'm already very uncomfortable with attention. So maybe it was fitting to have that direction. But I was very aware that I needed to be very good. And I didn't, you know, I couldn't do anything wrong.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Gisele Barreto Fetterman. And she's got a brand new book. It's called Radical Tenderness and it's subtitled The Value of Vulnerability in an Often Unkind World. She's married to John Fetterman, who was the mayor of Braddock, where they live. He also was lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania and is currently a U.S. senator. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and our guest today on the show is Gisele Barreto Fetterman, again, wife of Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman. We've been talking about her new book called Radical Tenderness, The Value of Vulnerability in an Often Unkind World, talking about her years as an undocumented immigrant. We'll be talking more about her life in the public eye and her husband's struggle with depression. Let me just pick up on the fact that you were undocumented. You were essentially a dreamer, as you have been called. But I wonder, too, whether you saw families being broken up, whether it was ICE agents or others coming in and taking somebody away.
There were always the rumors. And, you know, if it happens to one family, the news passes quickly through a community. There was one family personally that I was very close with that did happen to them. And they had two sons. They owned a home and they were removed. It was like 2 a.m. and they were deported to Brazil. So I did have it happen to someone very close to me. But the stories, we heard them every day, you know, they were always. And once you know that it could happen and it's that close to you, then it's that much more real.
I'm curious about your reaction to today, where we're seeing, and they're almost every day, we're seeing videos of people, undocumented people being grabbed off the street by ICE agents who are masked, thrown into unmarked cars, taken to detention centers. We don't know where. There's no due process that we're aware of unless lawyers or courts get involved. What are your thoughts about what's going on in America today?
It's heartbreaking. You know, there was a Brazilian film recently that was very popular. It was Ainda Estou Aqui, I'm Still Here. And it addressed the disappearance of political folks in the 70s when Brazil was militaristic. And these are things you think aren't going to happen here, right? And of course, I grew up with those fears. It never looked like it looks like today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, immigrants have so much to offer. And it's just heartbreaking to see that. And, you know, I feel like we have to constantly prove our value, right? Like mm-hmm. during COVID, it was all mostly immigrants that were still keeping things open and keeping the country moving. The food we eat every day is picked by them. And, you know, they contribute so much to society. But not only that, like, they're just humans. And mm-hmm. that's enough, right? I think contributing is great, but just wanting to have a better life for your family is enough. And, you know, this country is made by those who want to be here and want to make it great. And I think about adoption and how beautiful adoption is and choosing a family. And to choose this home, I think, is the ultimate honor, to choose America as your home. So it's heartbreaking. Every single day is a heartbreak.
I mean, you're married to a U.S. senator, so chances are you're not going to get nabbed off the street. But can you imagine being at your grocery store, you know, not surrounded by, I don't know if you have Secret Service or not, but just on your own, picking up some bananas or whatever. Can you imagine being targeted?
No, but it's happening every single day to our neighbors.
And you're seeing it.
It's heartbreaking.
You had an incident, in fact, I interviewed you about this about 5 years ago, where you were actually in Aldi, you were standing in line in Aldi to get, I think it was kiwis or something.
Golden kiwis.
And this woman came up to you and called you the N-word. She called you a thief and was very aggressive and very threatening to you. And you got in your car to go home, I guess, and she came to the window and continued to threaten you. And I remember you describing just feeling like you were that 10-year-old girl again, and here you were being threatened by somebody.
Right. I think the level of hate that I got to witness in her face as someone who didn't know me at all was terrifying. And I think that's what we see now. How can you absolutely hate someone, one for any reason, but someone you don't know, you don't know their story, you don't know anything about them, and to have that level of hate in your heart, you know, and it's really terrifying that exists in the world, because the stories I tell myself of, like, this is a person who wasn't loved enough. And, mm-hmm. you know, they don't apply in those situations because it's much more dark than that.
In fact, you said, and apparently people knew who she was. I mean, she was identified or whatever. But your response was, I guess it was on Twitter, or X, or whatever it was called back then. You know, teach her love. Don't, like, you know, troll her or pile on with this woman.
Right. I don't think we change through shame. I don't think shame has ever been an effective tool in changing human behavior. I think it has to look like something else.
Just to follow up on this, and even talking about today, what President Trump says about immigrants, I was thinking about this alligator Alcatraz, as it's called, which, you know, the sort of sadism involved in that is really disturbing, the idea of inflicting pain, enjoying the inflicting of pain on someone else. And he was asked, is the idea that if some illegal immigrant escapes, they will get eaten by an alligator or a snake? And his response was, well, I guess that's the concept.
Right. And And you see that message out in the world, and the likes and the comments and the celebratory, you know, wording to it is shocking. I mean, I don't recommend anyone read comments, because it's just, it's where your brain goes to rot. Right. But if you take time, you will find names you recognize who may be your neighbors, who may work at the library or at the grocery store, who believe this or feel this way or are celebrating those comments in that moment.
So how does, to use the title of your book, how does radical tenderness deal with alligator Alcatraz?
I mean, I cry a lot about it, but I know that I won't add any negativity into the world. I will not cause harm to anyone. I know that I'm responsible for myself. That's something that I can do. If that inspires someone to do the same, that's great, but I won't add to that. You know, we can't change everything. There's a lot we can't change. And the next 3 years are going to be awful, and we can't change that. But if we destroy each other alive in these 3 years, there'll be nothing in the next term. So I try to think of it like that, a way to actually solve this in the future. Because the way we're going, I don't think it's going that way.
Your husband went to Mar-a-Lago to meet with President Trump. I think you went with him.
I did. I went too.
Did he know you were undocumented?
I talked about it.
What did you say to him?
And I, you know, I wasn't sure I was going to go, but I said, you know, this is who we have for the next 4 years. I think we have to have conversations with each other. I think it's the only way out of this. And I advocated for Dreamers. That's the reason I went. That was my goal. I'm going to talk about Dreamers. I'm going to share my story. And not to be naive to think I'm going to change his mind, but I should at least try.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I talked about. And I talked about the contributions of Dreamers and what undocumented people are families. They're not numbers. They're real people. And in that meeting, he said about Dreamers, he said he agrees. And he said that, you know, Dreamers are American. He said many of them don't even speak their native language. And
so how do you make sense of that when you see what the policy is?
I don't think there is sense to be made. I think this is what we have to get through until it changes. And, you know, the more people that are celebrating and giving him credit for the things he's saying and doing, it's just empowering him to continue to do more of that.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Giselle Barreto Fetterman, our guest today on The Connection. And again, she's written a new book. It's part memoir, it's largely memoir, a lot about herself, about growing up in America, being undocumented, now a citizen of the United States. The book called Radical Tenderness, The Value of Vulnerability in an Often Unkind World. Well, shifting gears, when you were going to, I guess you were going to a new school, and a teacher, you were nervous, as any child would be. And a teacher in this new class said, "Wherever you came from, however you got here, I'm so glad to see you." Now I'm going to cry.
That was Miss Barnhill.
But she said that to you. What did that mean to a little girl?
I just felt so welcomed, you know, and we're still in touch.
Are you?
Facebook friends. We message all the time. But I thought I learned from her that day how to be a welcomer. And my goal will be to be a welcomer. And I try to take these experiences and think, what did I learn from this experience? What did this person or this experience teach me? And what can I take on from this? And I thought, you know, what a simple thing to say, but was so powerful.
Yeah. I mean, it really has stayed with you. Yeah. How old were you at the time? What grade was that?
That's when I moved to New Jersey. So I was like 8 or 9.
Yeah. You also write about Mr. Rogers, you know, how welcoming he was. And I remember when our son was watching Mr. Rogers, who we called Roger. I know,
oh,
Roger.
Oh, my goodness. I would never.
But just the sense of, for lack of a better word, connection, you know, between a child and the television set and that man.
Right. But who has been that voice since him? There isn't. I mean, I try to think in my five, you know, in one hand, who has a delivery and a tone and a gentleness and a tenderness like Mr. Rogers? So this is really uncommon, because I can't think of another man, very few women, who live and carry and embody that.
And do it so directly,
and
right?
And he was so effective, right? I think I learned from him that you can say really hard things, but it's your delivery. Like, I tell the story about the girl who visited my home and said, oh, your home is so eclectic because none of my furniture matched. And that's really what she was saying, but she said it in such a lovely way. And then there is a way to say things that may be hard or difficult or challenging, but that allows for that connection to happen.
Well, talking about eclectic, and I mentioned this in the intro, that your mom sort of taught you and your brother to sort of be able to scan the streets looking for things that could bring joy and you could use in your own apartment or house.
Right. I mean, I think it was all survival tips, you know, and really to be really flexible mostly and to find a way. And if you didn't find it today, then tomorrow's another day. And if this way didn't work, then we try a different way. But she was really, it was really important to hear this idea that we can always start over. Because I think we need to know that at any age, at any time, we always were in control of that beginning.
And I guess even for furniture can start over, right?
For sure. Yeah, and there's so much life left in so many things. And I hate waste. I still can't drive past, you know, a curb full of furniture and not slow down and check out the goods.
Do you still dumpster dive? Do you do that?
No, I haven't in a long time, but it was a really fun time.
Any treasures you found that...
So the best memory of that was a behind a pharmacy, and it was an entire dumpster in bags full of chunky chocolate bars. Do you remember those? They're like the perfect square.
Yeah.
I ate a lot of chocolate that year. That was a really good time.
You talk about your mother and your grandmother as being cycle breakers, that they, you know, that they, perhaps there was violence in the family or sort of patterns that had been established living in Brazil, that they, by coming to America, sort of broke those patterns and started new, started afresh.
Right. And we can all do that. My grandmother was, you know, she had an evil stepmother. Her mother died when she was very, truly an evil stepmother. Was very abusive, and she was able to get her father to send her to boarding school. So she was raised by French nuns in Brazil at a boarding school. But her brother committed suicide from the abuse.
Oh, man.
And, you know, this is, she didn't go to college. She was a seamstress. She had young kids. And she raised four kids with so much love and the complete opposite of that. So I think we have to choose the path we take. We either continue to pass on what we've learned, the negative things we've experienced, or we tend to want to do the complete opposite of that. And that's a choice we make each day.
Did they talk about, you know, the old country, or was it, I think a lot of immigrants who come here, they're looking forward. They don't necessarily want to get nostalgic about the past.
My grandmother would tell a lot of stories. We would do trips, just the two of us. We did a lot of trips together, and so she would tell a lot of the stories, and I loved hearing every version of it, and every time she'd remember something more. But we all openly talked about mental health or suicide or these things, but it was never from an angle of victimhood. It was like, this is it. Like, life is going to be hard. How can we do differently? How can we move forward? And that was really important. I never looked at my childhood in any way as like, oh my God, I was undocumented and we poor. Like, we had the best time. Hmm. We had a great time. And there were challenges, but life, I think, is supposed to come with them. And the fun, I think, is finding your way out of them and through them.
You mentioned your mother telling you to be invisible and obviously not calling attention to yourself when you were undocumented. But I wonder, too, whether it also meant, it doesn't seem that way, but it also meant hiding your feelings. But I think one of the things that you're shaking your head no, and you don't seem like that, but you also write that you saw other immigrant families who were hiding their feelings, maybe for that very reason, just to sort of stay centered.
Right. It's survival. And, you know, our country, like our culture, Latinos aren't great about mental health, right? Like, it's changing today, as I think America changed more quickly. It is changing, but you didn't talk about that. You know, my family, we did, but I think my friends, we didn't. And it was really just survival. This is what you do. You can't sit around and cry about this because you got to figure out how to pay the rent this month.
you live in Braddock. You moved there when you fell in love with your husband and you got married and lived there. And you have this free store. You have a food rescue and some other nonprofit organizations there. How are people doing knowing that Medicaid, you know, could be dismantled? They could be affected by the loss of health care or maybe food stamps. What do you see happening in your own hometown?
It's challenging. I think anything you see playing out in the country, fears or, you know, challenges happening, communities like mine are feeling it in a much deeper level. And I try to offer support where I can. With the organizations I started, I try to think of what would have helped my family when I came here or other families like mine. And that's what I've tried to create, but spaces also that are joyful mm-hmm. and celebratory. And, I mean, people are going to figure out a way, and it's going to be really hard. But I think they have the worst expectations, right? Because I think we just expect the worst a lot. Though we're going to be there to support them as best we can. And hopefully this moves through more quickly.
Well, you're talking about community, right? You're talking about being with people as you struggle to figure out how to support each other.
Right. And I'm so in the community. Like I live in town, my nonprofit is in town, and I'm a firefighter in my community.
I know you're a firefighter.
So if there's a fire in town, chances are I know the family who was affected. If they lose everything and they need to go to the free store, I'm going to be there when they come. It's really very, very, my circle is very small in town. It's very, very connected. And I feel very lucky that I get to be let into that part of so many people's lives. And I'm very lucky to do that work.
We're almost up on our second break here, but I read that you changed some of the no parking signs. You had sort of yes signs versus instead of don't sit here, don't do this, don't do that. You invite people to do things.
Yes, I think we hear so much and read so much of all the things we're not supposed to do. And I think all spaces, I think regardless of where you live, you deserve to have beautiful surroundings. I think that really changes how we see the world, how we invest in our community. So I try to create beautiful spaces. I always say my work is about bread and flowers. Mm. We need the nourishment, but we also need joy and beauty in our lives. And I try to create that balance in my work.
Well, let's take that very short break and we'll get back to our conversation with Giselle Barreto Fetterman. And again, she's got a new book. It's called Radical Tenderness, and it's subtitled The Value of Vulnerability in an Often Unkind World. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, our guest is Giselle Barreto Fetterman. We've been talking about her new book called Radical Tenderness. She is married to U.S. Senator John Fetterman. They live in Braddock, where she has a couple of nonprofits, the Free Store, 412 Food Rescue, and something called For Good PGH. And as she just told us, she's also a firefighter. Let me read something that you wrote here that I thought was really interesting. You see, but I firmly believe that the remedy for despair is action. I cannot say for sure that my way is the right way. Sometimes I wonder if my tendency to go, 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 and my ability to adapt to any situation is actually a form of dissociation, perhaps rooted in the uncertainty of my childhood. I thought that was really interesting, this sense of dissociation. Expand on that for us.
I think I'm delusional at times in my work, but I think that's helpful, right? Like I believe the best in people all the time. And I know that's delusion at times, but it's okay because it helps me continue to do the work that I do with a lot of joy and a lot of love. I think we have different ways to cope. For me, you know, I have ADHD. For me, it's important to be very, very busy at all times.
Otherwise, you're bored.
Yes, like 1 hour without something to do. I'm like, what is my life? Where have I gone wrong? So I'm definitely go, go, go. But for me, it's how I'm most effective. Mm-hmm. And I think it's how I can handle high stress situations and national crises because I have that ability to be able to keep going.
You also have some serious back pain, right? Is that something you sort of live with, chronic pain?
Right, yeah. And it's I have spondylolisthesis, which is just a spine condition. And mm-hmm. It's been a part of my life for a long time. It's just there. I'm just used to it.
You tell a story in this book about you were hosting a party, I think in Braddock. Maybe you were the second lady of Pennsylvania, or slop, as you say. And you were mistaken for the help. Mm-hmm. Someone thought you were there to serve rather than being the second lady of Pennsylvania. What did you do?
It's happened often, and I remember thinking, like, I don't care if they think that. Like, I don't need to justify my existence. But I think that day I had a glass of wine, and I was, like, maybe a little spicy. And we were hosting, it was 2 book events at our home from 2 local authors. And, you know, there were 200 people in my home, which I love hosting, but it was overwhelmed for a minute. I went into my pantry, I took a glass of wine, and I came out, and this woman said, I just want you to know I saw what you did, and I'm going to tell Mr. Fetterman. And in the moment, I probably would have just maybe cried or just not said anything. I don't know. That's usually my reaction. But like I said, I think the wine made me a little spicy. And I said, please don't tell him. I don't want to get fired. And I just walked away. But knowing that within the next 5-10 minutes, we were going to welcome all these guests to our home, which is what happened very shortly after. And she was right in the front of that crowd as we welcomed them to our home. And she was obviously mortified.
Yeah.
Came over, immediately apologized, told me she considered leaving, but knew that Pittsburgh was too small.
Right.
And just was so sorry. And I think that was the most effective. Right, I learned that you can be really effective in a really gentle way, and maybe be playful if that helps. I think that gives me strength to be playful in that moment. But it worked out.
Yeah.
And it often does.
And it sounded like the two of you were able to have a good heart-to-heart.
We did. We had wine together, and she said that she was, like, ashamed. She was embarrassed on her own, right? It is not my job to bring shame. And for me, it's really important that every exchange I have someone, both parties leave with dignity. So that's really important. And it's happened many times. It's happened at the pool. It's happened.
Where they think you're the nanny, right?
Right. And maybe, you know, maybe because they think I'm so young. The pool was kind of funny. I had the 3 kids. I was speaking to them in Portuguese, which I often do. And the mom said, oh, it's so cool that you're teaching them another language. And I was like, wow, like how nice. And she said, when I was looking to find help, I couldn't find anyone who spoke another language. They're really lucky to have you. And I said, well, I hope they keep me around. And I did that because she's sitting beside me. I have 3 tiny kids who are going to say mom 10,000 times before she left the pool, which is what they did.
Right.
And we had another similar exchange.
Yeah.
And I think dignity is really important. I think you need it to be able to grow, and shame isn't what does that.
And humor helps a little bit, too.
I think it does.
Like a little needly humor. Well, let me ask you about your husband, Senator John Fetterman. As you write, and as you have said before, he was campaigning to be a senator, and you noticed this kind of droop. You were on a stop somewhere. You noticed this droop in his mouth. And an alarm went off. You just felt like something is not right. And you said, we have to go to the hospital. He said, no, 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 everything is fine. But it seems like you prevailed. And once you got there, he had a stroke.
Right, yes. It was, it was all very much luck. His mouth just moved differently for a second. It didn't stay in that position. His speech wasn't affected. So things you expect of a stroke. He had no physical pain. The only thing that was a flag for me was his mouth, moving in a way that I know our mouths weren't capable of moving. So we had troopers at that time, and he's saying, I'm fine. She's crazy. And for someone to look at him, no one would have thought he was having a stroke.
So just a momentary droop?
Just a momentary droop. That was it. And I must have seen a PSA at some point that stuck with me. And we got him to the hospital, and he was having a stroke.
Yeah. You also write that, I think this was back in 2017, he had had some, I guess a doctor had said, you have some issues with your heart, something he did not follow up on.
Right, he had AFib.
AFib, okay.
And he didn't follow up, like, you know, 7 out of 10 men, which I guess, you know, we have to do better, guys. You know, I don't know why folks are afraid. I guess I understand in many ways why they don't want to get checked or follow up, but, you know, they really should.
But is he the kind of guy who would just, no, I don't want to deal with it. I'm fine. Leave me alone. That kind of thing.
I mean, everybody's more important than him. And, you know, he has to, all these other things have to be done first. He'll be fine. But that's not a reality when you have a family and kids. And but I've had a lot of folks who wrote me, men, who said, you know, I went to get checked because of this. I learned from this experience. So, you know, there was definitely positive in that it inspired folks to change that cycle and behave differently.
After he won the election, beating out Mehmet Oz, he won really handily. I think he won every single county in the state.
All 67 counties.
All 67 counties in the Commonwealth. As you describe it, he was just sad and alone in his room. He couldn't feel any joy or celebrate. Do you think that was the sign that this depression was beginning to take over his life?
Yeah, and, you know, I thought, oh, you know, all this stress is behind him. Like, now things are going to be different because he's overcome all of this. And, you know, he already was a very melancholic person, mm-hmm. already had signs of depression just naturally. It's who he is. When I read about, you know, Abraham Lincoln's memoirs, very similar personality in that sense. But stroke will increase your chances of depression drastically. So mm-hmm. I think it was the combination of that. And when I saw that, you won, like, it's behind you, and that cloud was not lifting, then I knew it was something more serious.
Yeah. And this was something, I don't know if it was a lifelong dream of his, but this was something that he really wanted, to be a senator from Pennsylvania.
Not lifelong, but it was something he had worked really hard in that time. And it was like, I will get this taken care of as soon as this is over. Like, this, I can't let Pennsylvania down. And that's how we got there.
Yeah. Well, he did check himself into Walter Reed. I think he was there for something like 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's obviously a very public thing when a U.S. senator does something like that. And he got a lot of praise for being open about it and discussing it and so taking the stigma off of mental illness and off of depression. Were you encouraging him to do this? Were you kind of behind the scenes saying, John, it's important to speak up?
Yeah, no, I was really proud of him. And even the conversations I had with the kids, I was like, he checked himself in. It was my oldest 15th birthday, like on the day of his birthday. So I got the kids together. I said, guys, I have amazing news. And they're thinking, I'm going to say, we're going to go to Disney. And I was like, your dad checked himself in. And they're like, what? Is this good news? And I said, yes, this is amazing news. Like, we are so proud of him. So for me, it was really important to get in early with them and set the tone of the conversation because it was something to be celebrated. And then, you know, I got them on board, but they thought they were going somewhere.
Well, it's been really scary for them. I mean, not any time anyone has to be hospitalized, it's obviously very serious, but also all the publicity around it, it's got to have been tough.
Of course, and all the days are tough. And, you know, the day this happened, we arrived home and the whole house was circled with media trucks. Yeah. You know, I think media has been very hard about respecting my autonomy and understanding that we're two different people. So that's been a challenge for me because I don't want attention. Like, I didn't sign up to be a politician. I don't like that world. I just want to do my work. But the media certainly does not respect family in that sense. Like I said, I had my kids and the whole house was surrounded by media trucks.
So how much do you hate not just media, but also politics?
I mean, I dislike it very deeply. I try not to hate anything. I dislike it very deeply. I wish it could be something different. You know, the spouses in the Senate have a really great group, and we hang out and talk about things, and we're bipartisan. That's very unique. And I think we have to talk to each other if we want to get out of this world alive in one piece as long as we can and get home each night. But I think the times have changed where if you talk to someone who thinks differently than you, you're a traitor or you're criticized. So for me, that's very hard because I think that's the only way is to talk to people who think differently than you.
I'm sure you're very aware of these articles that have been written about your husband in the last couple of months. I certainly read them as well, where members of his staff are on the one hand, you could say being critical. On the other hand, it sounds like also very concerned about his mental health, feeling as if he is not taking care of himself. He's not following protocols that he was given after being released from or signing out from Walter Reed Hospital. How do you see him? And depression isn't something that you just sort of magically goes away. But how do you see his mental health?
His mental health is great. I think what's challenging is that if you're in the public world, those accounts or those disgruntled staffers, that's celebrated. That's clickbait. That's exciting. That's juicy. And I think, you know, you said he was very celebrated when he checked himself in. Well, yeah. He was somewhat celebrated. He was also highly criticized. And I think once you have the stigma of mental health, it will follow you, unfortunately. So as much as I encourage folks to get help, to talk about it, it can also hurt you still in the long term. I've seen that with him.
Yeah, but is he doing what the doctors are telling him to do?
Heart is great. He takes everything. He learned his lesson. And I think he inspired a lot of other men to also learn a lesson from this experience.
But was there a period where he sort of was thinking, and it's not unusual for people that have had an incident like this to think, oh, well, you know, I'm going to be okay. I can sort of go back to my life, and then finding, no, I actually need to be on medications and
He follows everything, does every checkup. But like I said, the stigma follows him.
I'll be honest with you. In some of the interviews that I've seen with him on television and things that I've read, it doesn't sound like he likes his job. It sounds like he would rather be home with you and the kids. Is there some truth to that?
I mean, I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes you get locked in there and they don't let you leave. And, you know, the one thing he looks forward to in his life is going to the shore with the kids once a year. It's a very humble vacation, 4 days at the Jersey Shore. So it's not that at all. I think there's a lot of things he wished were differently there. But again, he's his own person and, you know.
Well, clear. And you are your own person as well. But so how do you handle all the sort of publicity or the things that have been written? And as I said, I read it as a objective outsider. So I'm not, you know, I'm not married to him, so I don't have a stake in it. But what I read were people, they were concerned. They were concerned about him missing votes. They were concerned that, you know, he wasn't sitting in on possibly very boring meetings. And
I mean, I think clickbait is always going to be popular, and that's what they're going to write. And they write that about all sorts of different folks in politics, and it's no different with him.
You write in the book, and it's interesting, this is about your children, or I think there was a discussion in the car, and one of your kids said, well, are you and Daddy going to get divorced? And I think all kids ask that, and he said, no. And you said,
maybe.
Maybe.
Right. I don't want any one experience to be debilitating to the children, whether it was when Dad had a stroke or whether it was a friendship circle that they're in breaking apart. I think it's important to know that whatever happens, then we can get through it together, whether that's divorce, whether that's a health, a medical emergency, it doesn't matter. I wanted them to know that not one thing should debilitate them, that there is a way forward through whatever happens.
And is Daddy going to get better? I don't know. I mean, that was your answer.
Right. When he had a stroke, he said, is Daddy going to be okay? I said, I don't know. I think so.
Right.
But I don't know. I think it's really important to give kids the truth. I want to do it in a gentle way, but I want to be honest. But are any of us going to be okay? I don't know. So, I mean, that's life. You don't know what you're going to get, and you do your best, and that's it.
And very quickly, we're almost out of time. How do you like being a firefighter? I know it's something that you signed up for.
I love being a firefighter.
Because?
Because it's, you know, you're meeting someone probably on their worst day, and you get to be there to help them through it. hopefully you both get out in one piece and safe. But I love it.
Well, Giselle Barreto Fetterman, thank you very much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And again, the book is titled Radical Tenderness, The Value of Vulnerability in an Often Unkind World. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder with Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.